The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome to the symposium. Today we're joined by Bo and Josh, and we're going to talk about one of the Theban plays of Sophocles. We're going to talk about Oedipus Rex. Now, that's an interesting topic as far as I'm concerned, and a lot of people wouldn't expect it. I've certainly had some people telling me that I wouldn't expect this to be a topic for a symposium, but I think that it is uniquely appropriate because there is so much into this play, and I really think that it's a good ground for discussion. And it has all sorts of questions like fate, moral responsibility, sometimes the theme that we can be our own worst enemy. I just think it's going to be a super discussion.
Yeah, it's really deep. It's a really complicated play. Well, the plot line and the themes that it discusses are really quite deep and a bit complex and ambiguous. So there's loads there to talk about, I think, of course. It's almost surprising how kind of complex it is, in a way. Because Sophocles is writing in, what, the 5th century?
Yes.
The 5th century, BC, that is. So, you know, a long, long time ago.
Yes.
Deep in antiquity. And yet, the Theban plays, or Oedipus Tyrannus, Oedipus the King, Oedipus Rex, it's much more complex than almost anything that gets made today. Or is, in fact, much, much, much more complex than nearly any film that gets made today or something. So, there's tons to talk about, isn't there, I think?
Yeah. And it has been a play that is considered to be one of the greatest tragedies of all time. It is massively influential with respect to how drama is conducted. And also it has a weird way of spilling into psychology.
It does indeed. I suppose this is my cue. I heard that you were talking about this, and I suggested that I join as well, because there is a sort of legacy following on, obviously in much more recent years in the grand sum of history, particularly because of Sigmund Freud and the sort of whole psychoanalysis thing of the Oedipus complex. And of course, this refers to a son's desire to sleep with his mother, which I think is more of a revealed preference of Sigmund Freud than an actual thing. I think that actually he was trying to rationalise his own perversions. And I think that actually the story shows that men will go to great lengths not to sleep with their mother. That's actually the whole point of the story. And that in using the story as the name for his theory, he's unintentionally disproved it, because the story itself is, you know, the complete opposite of what he was using it for.
Okay, we will definitely go there, but let me just say that I don't think it's your only cue into the discussion, because we have talked about moral responsibility before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the main questions here is whether Oedipus is morally responsible for what he has done. He certainly feels that he is. But that's a major question to be asked afterwards. And I think that it goes straight to the deepest philosophical questions when it comes to discussing what we are morally responsible for and what not. Mm-hmm. So I think we should say that a lot of the tragedies were not original screenplays in what sense? In the sense that they were reinterpreting something that was already part of the lore of ancient Greece. So for instance, there was a huge mythological tradition, and we know that there were some mythographers, people who wrote down myths, and they tried to codify the several myths. One of the most influential ones that we have now, and it's widely available, you can find it definitely in Amazon, it's by the Library of Greek Mythology by Apollodorus. And there's a debate whether he actually wrote it or not. Some people say it's from Pseudo-Apollodorus or something, but it's a very dense but good codification of ancient Greek mythology, and a lot of people who study ancient Greek mythology are using it as one of the major sources. I think definitely the Homeric epics are one of the other major sources, because especially there is a part in the Odyssey where I think it's 20 pages or something, where we hear a lot of the myths just spilled together. It's a really interesting thing to bear in mind. So there was a myth of Oedipus that Sophocles was reinterpreting into a play. And we will talk a bit about what the myth was, but it's a really interesting thing to bear in mind that what Sophocles was doing, in a sense, could be interpreted as a political claim in Athens. So, of course, there are several dimensions, but the play was staged in the very early period of the Peloponnesian War, where there was a plague in Athens caused by the Spartans outside the Athenian walls. And I don't think it is a coincidence that the play starts with a plague in Thebes. It was a means by which the audience was going to immediately relate to the play. And let me just say about tragedy that tragedy became what it became in the 5th century in Athens. And the three major tragedians were, or at least whose works survive till now, were Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides. And Sophocles is sort of the middle child. Aeschylus was a bit, was much older. I think he was a generation older. He was born in around 525 BC and died in 456, whereas Sophocles was born in around 497 BC and died 406. And Euripides was born around 480 and died at 406, again in the Peloponnesian War. So we should bear in mind that a lot of these tragedians, they are not actually creating a story from scratch. They are taking something from the lore that the audience knew already and could relate to, and they are making some interventions with the play. And I think that the play was not cancelled. The plays were not cancelled even during the plague. So it was the COVID of the time. They didn't cancel the theatre and drama. So I think we should talk a bit about the myth of the Sphinx and the myth of Oedipus.
Would it be worthwhile talking just a little bit about the role of tragedy and its purpose before we get onto that? Just because I think there are some interesting things to say about it, because I find it interesting in particular that tragedies carry the same sort of weight in people's minds as some of the other sort of genres of play. And I find that interesting because the sort of initial superficial analysis that you could do of people's attitudes towards it might say, well, tragedies deal with lots of negative emotions. Generally speaking, people prefer positive emotions. So what's going on here? What is the motivation of the people writing it and the people who were interested in it? Because, of course, it's fair to say they did quite well, right? And so there's got to be an appetite there. And I think it's interesting, I didn't know that there was actually a plague going on in Athens around the time that it was being performed. So it seems to me that catharsis is probably going to be a very significant aspect of it, in that dealing with negative emotions in a play is one of the ways in which you can flesh out your ideas around these negative things. Like all of the themes dealt with in the story, there are lots of different potential bad things that could happen to a person. And I think that perhaps that's the appeal, particularly to the audience, as well as, I think, from the perspective of someone who writes tragedy, there's a certain amount of morality involved in there, isn't there? It seems to me that there are moral lessons to be learnt from this tragedy. And I think that perhaps that was one of the motivations to formalise these myths in a sort of play. I don't know what you both think about that.
Yeah, the plague in Athens. You haven't watched mine and Carl's History Bro video from like 5 years ago on the Peloponnesian War?
I have.
Really?
A very long time ago.
Thucydides talks all about it. But there's loads of things to say. When you do classics, even at undergrad, you have to get involved. You're sort of forced, really, to get involved in Greek theatre.
Yeah.
One way or another. And you have to sort of touch on Euripides, Sophocles and Aeschylus. But I think what's interesting is Sophocles himself and his place in history. So he was very, very young, around the age of the Battle of Salamis, in like 480. He would have been 16, 17 years old, something like that. And he lived up to be an old man. So he lived sort of perfectly through, in a way, sort of perfectly through the Persian Wars, or that more famous segment of the Persian Wars, you know, that Thucydides tells us all about. And that he was even a general and or a statesman on some level, and was involved in the Sicilian expedition and all sorts of things. And so he wasn't just a playwright in Athens. He was a really, really, really important person who also happened to write plays, it seems. And one thing to mention in classical Athens in the age of Pericles, or directly after, is that sort of full male citizens, you were sort of obliged, or you had to attend a theatre. Now that's odd to us, isn't it?
Yes.
To go and see a play is just entirely up to you, usually, isn't it? But the fact that it's sort of part of your civic duty. And as you mentioned, it's obviously used, fairly obviously used, as a vehicle to talk about politics of your day, even. Sort of very, very thinly veiled, really.
Yeah.
In all sorts of ways. I think that you also made a good point that's worth underlining, really, is that that's what's left to us. We've got Euripides and Sophocles and Aeschylus. That's what left to us. And only a portion of that. So they think, the real scholars think, that Sophocles might have written 120, 130 odd plays, and we've got six or seven?
I think we have close to seven that are complete.
Extant, yeah. And we've got tiny snippets of loads of others, dozens of others.
Yeah.
But sort of the three famous ones, because Oedipus Tyrannus is part of a trilogy, and he didn't write them in chronological order.
Yeah.
but there's Oedipus Colonus, right? And then Antigone.
Yeah.
And Antigone's his daughter. We probably won't talk about that much in this one. But yeah, the last thing that I'll quickly say, just as a very, very, very quick whirlwind few words about ancient Greek tragedy, is, of course, Aristotle, quite a lot later, wrote his Poetics, which is talking all about, well, all sorts of things, but among them is sort of the nature of theatre and tragedy and what should be. And he's just a massive fanboy of Oedipus Tyrannus and Sophocles, and thinks it's sort of the perfect story, or the perfect tragedy at least. But you can see that various plot devices and things are still used to this day, that Sophocles used in this. So it'd be interesting to get into it. And there's loads more psychology stuff to talk about than merely the Oedipus complex, which... Yeah, I feel like Freud, he should have called it the anti-Oedipus complex or something. It's the opposite. But anyway, we'll get into that when it comes up.
So I think you are raising two really interesting questions. The one is the psychological one of why do we sort of feel drawn sometimes from plays that deal with negative emotions. And there are a lot of other stuff with respect to what was tragedy and who was Sophocles in ancient Athens. Because I think that when we are looking at the history of the time, we are becoming aware of several contextual factors that allow us to understand much better some plays and what the playwright, their author meant to convey. So when it comes to the emotions, I never thought of myself as someone who would enjoy tragedy. I mean, it's not that it's an issue of enjoyment, but it seems to me that it is a bit enchanting. But consciously speaking, I sort of didn't see the appeal to it until I read it. And when I read it, it has a mysterious, enchanting quality about it. And I don't know exactly why that is, but I kind of respect it. And I think that it has a lot of things to say about the human condition.
I think that in it being a tragedy, it is also making comments on human desires, isn't it? Because, of course, if everything is going wrong to a certain extent, then there has to be a vision of what things going right looks like. That's kind of a subtext of it in a certain sense, that the audience has to understand what the ideal situation would be. And so it forces the audience to grapple with negative and positive emotions and visions of their own future in a certain extent. So those are actually very important things. So it serves an important function, even though superficially, sort of at face value, you might say, well, why would someone want to engage in something which doesn't have a happy ending? It's going to make you feel bad, but it doesn't necessarily do that.
I think this also ties into why some people are drawn to horror films. And I've heard that I also didn't like them, but after a while I've started loving them. And I think that I heard somewhere that when we're looking at horror films, we are much more able to process negative emotions and emotions of terror by separating ourselves from what we are looking at. It's not that we are in a context where we are sort of immediately in danger. We do feel present, but there is something that gives us sort of the time to ponder on it in ways that we don't have when we're actually threatened.
I think people definitely are drawn to negative things, horrible, ugly things.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Not just in art, something that, a piece of oil on canvas, which is ugly. Not just that, but like, you know, TV shows about how terrible it is to be in prison or something, or the plight of a morbidly obese person.
Yeah.
Or just in real life, an actual car crash, people slow down to make sure they can see it. People love all that sort of thing. So the idea that a tragedy is something that ends badly, that doesn't make you feel good about yourself or the world, there's still a massive audience for that. In fact, making content here, unfortunately, we realised that even though some people love a white pill, the vast majority of people prefer a black pill. That's just the numbers that seem to play
that
out.
Often contradict what some people say, that stop with the black pills and give us white pills.
Some people really like white pills, ask for white pills. They're in the minority. It's sad to say. I was a bit disappointed, in the broadest sense, with humanity when we discovered that. I was like, oh no, really? But I suppose it's obvious, in a way. The giant appeal of horror films, or even gore films, over-the-top gore films. People lap it up.
There's a lot to be said here on the sort of psychological realm. I think what you're saying, Bo, brings to mind prospect theory, that prospective losses are twice as emotionally significant as equivalent gains. And basically what that means is if you stand to lose, I don't know, £5, or you stand to gain £5, losing the five is twice as bad as gaining the five. And so losses play a disproportionate amount of significance in our own minds. And I think also people have a morbid curiosity. And I think it is curiosity a lot of the time, because these things that people are curious about, the negative things, you know, car crashes and things like that, you're only really interested if you haven't had first-hand experience of it. If you've had a car crash yourself, all of a sudden a car crash of someone else seems a little bit less novel and interesting. Not to say that, you know, they're not necessarily going to be invested, but certainly less so than someone who's never seen one before, and the novelty is still there. And I think to harken back to what you were saying, Stelios, I think the degree of separation is very important, because if you're looking at it at a sort of neurological level, you sort of have this core concept, this sort of cognitive schema, if you will, in which things are built out upon. You can almost imagine the neural networks building around this main neural pathway. And it's significant because the diffusion then removes the negative emotion to a certain extent. Because, of course, when you're watching a play, you won't feel nearly as negative as if you were in the same scenario yourself.
Yeah.
And actually that degree of removal from the situation helps people build sort of psychological yeah. structures in their mind that allows them to think about these issues, if they're confronted with comparable ones in real life, in a way that is perhaps less emotionally straining, and therefore they're going to make a perhaps more rational and better decision out of it as well. And I think people have an intuitive sense of this. You're not necessarily consciously aware of it going on, but people can, they kind of have a feeling going away from something that tells them that they've gone away with a little bit more knowledge about a certain negative thing.
And this curiosity is really central to Oedipus Rex, because it is his curiosity to find out about himself in a way that leads him to understand the tragic truth. And before we talk a bit about the myth of Oedipus, I want to say something about Sophocles that I think may be relevant. He was, I think, involved in a sort of coup against Ephialtes. And Ephialtes is not the Ephialtes who betrayed the Spartans. He was the Ephialtes in Athens. He was a populist Democrat.
And later.
After. I think in 450.
Thermopylae.
Yeah.
Right.
Long after.
Yeah,
right. These are two different Ephialtes. Mm. And he was considered to be a bit more Spartan friendly, I think. And to a degree, a lot of commentators have said that Oedipus, for him, represents something like the spirit of Athenian democracy or the spirit of Pericles. So in Thucydides, for instance, there is the funeral oration where Pericles is talking about the spirit of Athenians that is very extroverted. And he was basically saying that it's the best system and they're basically the best. That was sort of like Athenian exceptionalism of the time. And a lot of people are saying that the kind of prideful nature of Oedipus in the beginning is a direct criticism of what Sophocles considered to be the prideful nature of Athenian democracy.
Or of Pericles before the war started or something.
Yes.
Maybe.
And in a way, a lot of people are saying that because he was a bit more Spartan friendly and a bit more traditional, he introduced this play as a means of criticism and warning that this kind of mentality will destroy Athens. Now, that's one interpretation. I'm not saying that it's the correct one or not, but I have heard a lot of people saying this, especially in Greece. And several famous scholars, at least contemporary ones. And I think it's an interesting thing to share.
Mm.
Now, let us talk a bit about the lore and where the myth of Oedipus features in it. And also bear in mind that, for instance, a lot of the tragedians were reinterpreting the lore. Let me just give an example. I think both Sophocles, Aeschylus, and Euripides, they have a play called Electra. Electra is the daughter of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra. And I think Orestes is also the her brother. Mm. And so they all reinterpreted Electra's position in the lore. Now, it's important to think of the myth of Oedipus and talk a bit about, you know, the Theban cycle and the Theban myths. So Oedipus is famous for having solved, in a sense, the riddle of the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. We are going to give the myth now, so you listen to it and you can judge the play better and on its merits, because the people who would watch the play already knew the myth. So basically, we have King Laius and Queen Jocasta of Thebes. And they heard Apollo's priest or priestess, don't remember what it was, who told Laius that you're going to be killed by your son. And because he was afraid of that prophecy, they gave birth to a son. Or I think it was Apollo, the library of Greek mythology says that they tried not to have a son, but at some point they were drunk and they got it on. And Oedipus was born. And when he was 3 days old, Laius pierced his ankles and he gave him to Jocasta. Jocasta gave Oedipus to a shepherd, and they told him to go to Mount Kithaeron and let the baby die and be consumed by wolves or
die of exposure.
Die of exposure and the beasts there. And let us say that Oedipus in Greek means swollen feet. Mm. And the feet were swollen because they were pierced by Laius. And what happened was that the shepherd was pitted the boy. I think that there's a rough equivalent with the history of Cyrus the Great, that the shepherd pitted him and he gave him to the people in Persia there.
Okay. Also, there's all sorts of parallels with Sargon, with Moses, with Zeus and Knossos, that the boy, the prophecy that the boy will usurp or kill the father.
Yes.
There's the same few sort of themes that come up in myths, aren't there? It's very, very similar all over the world.
I think this could be interpreted as a criticism of the corruption of power, because to think that a father would kill his son or let his son die of exposure because he heard a prophecy or something seems a bit far-fetched, at least to people with our sensitivities. Maybe people back then didn't think so.
I've always thought that a shepherd is meant to represent the sort of pure and innocence of the common people in a story. That's kind of what I think of, because their instincts are sort of presented as being innately sort of as a guardian, because they're guarding their sheep, aren't they?
Yeah.
And so there's a sort of very subtle subtext there that a good person who cares about other people protects other people, perhaps even people he doesn't know very well. I mean, he's probably not particularly well versed in each individual sheep, I don't know. But you would presume that there's a certain amount of benevolence there, right?
I don't think you're wrong in any way. Don't think what I'm about to say, I'm trying to say you're wrong. But I just think the classical Peloponnese was filled with shepherds. Yeah. We're always told that. Like, nearly everyone is a shepherd, almost. Not quite that, of course. But but everything you said is still also true. But the idea that it's weird that you would hear a prophecy that your son is going to usurp or kill you at some point, so you kill them all. That's crazy. That's crazy to us.
Yeah.
Weirdly extreme to us. But like I say, in the Zeus story, his father, I think, eats all the boys when they're born. another parallel with Romulus and Remus, where the story that kids are abandoned to die and that they don't die and they grow up and go on to do great things. That's a well-used trope almost, isn't it?
And by the way, let me just say that when people implied that gods were being unjust, there were people who criticized that, like Plato, for instance. Plato thinks that poets and mythologists, they are insane and blasphemous when they're presenting gods as acting in a puny way. And I mentioned what you're talking about, what Cronus did, for instance, when he was devouring his children. Plato thought that this is, it's completely blasphemous. You shouldn't be allowed to say things like that. To go back to Oedipus, that shepherd there found another shepherd from Corinth and he gave it to him. And the other shepherd took him to Polybus and Merope, the king and queen of Corinth. Now, in some versions of the myth, it's not Merope the name, it's another name, but that's, we need to bear in mind that there were all sorts of people giving versions of that myth, so that's the one that has been registered. And they loved Oedipus, and I think it is implied that they loved Oedipus because they couldn't bear children of their own, and they wanted to hide the truth from him. But at some point, Oedipus got into a banquet, went into a banquet, and there was a drunkard there telling him that you're not who you think you are. Your parents are not Polybus and Merope.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.